Greetings, friends. My name is Jessa McLean, and I'm here to provide you with some blueprints of disruption. This weekly podcast is dedicated to amplifying the work of activists, examining power structures, and sharing the success stories from the grassroots. Through these discussions, we hope to provide folks with the tools and the inspiration they need to start to dismantle capitalism, decolonize our spaces, and bring about the political revolution that we know we need.
Good morning, everybody. We've got a few people in the studio with us today, so we're just going to do a little bit of a round circle and have them introduce themselves. I'm going to start with Louise, please.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me here. My name is Louise Smith, and I organize with, I'm based in Toronto, and I organize with Independent Jewish Voices, with Jews Say No to Genocide, and also once cities started creating bylaws that were set up to prevent protest. I was also involved with setting up a coalition. That's the Coalition for Charter Rights and Freedoms.
Did you just introduce me to something new? Scribbling in my notes there. Thank you, Louise. Molly, please.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm Molly Kraft. I am a co-founder of Showing Up for Racial Justice Toronto, the first American chapter of the first Canadian chapter of the American organization aimed at getting more white people to actively fight against white supremacy in their communities. And as part of that, one of the original members of the Jews Say No to Genocide coalition
of anti-Zionist, pro-Palestinian Jewish organizations in Canada that came together to organize after October 7th to make sure that there was a proud Jewish voice showing up for Palestinian movements in Canada.
You're involved with a lot of the organizations that I absolutely look up to. I was at an event for Surge, an online webinar, and I have this write-up in my drafts ready to go on. It was migrant rights. You had the folks on there to raise funds, and I thought you guys did such a good job in the event. I felt so energized, even though it was a webinar. That's kind of a side note, but when you said you were Surge, I was like, I have to mention that.
That's awesome.
Thank you. And Gur is back. Yes. Remind the audience, please.
Yes, amazing, Jessa. Thanks for having us and being so generous with your platform. I'm Gur Sabar. I am a member of Independent Jewish Voices and a member and spokesperson for Jews Say No to Genocide, and also the executive director of the Movement Media Hub.
All right. A few weeks ago, there was an act of gun violence in Australia that a lot of people started talking about. Bondi Beach. Why are we talking about Bondi Beach? Well, because it led to another discussion altogether. And the narratives that surround that event are important, and they will impact the work that we do. And so also keeping in mind, it's a bit of a sensitive time and a sensitive topic. We're going to ease into it a little bit. But Molly, in that moment, when you saw this happen in the news and it was clear that people who were targeted were Jewish, what were your initial thoughts?
That's such a good question. And I think initially there's always like a moment of shock and devastation and wondering like who has been killed and why they've been killed. And I think for many of us Jews on the left, the first place we go is like, please don't let this be like a Muslim or Arab person, because we know that that will make this all so much worse. And so I think for me, what I tried to do was just read as much as I possibly could. And of course, within minutes, this act, like you said, which was really an act of gun violence that ended up being an anti-Semitic act targeted at the Jewish community in Australia, pretty sort of like openly, was starting to be used to manipulate dialogue about pro-Palestinian movements. And I think that's a terror that every Jewish person on the left fears, which is that anti-Semitism, present everywhere, present for hundreds of years, anytime it occurs, will be used to do further harm to Palestinians and to Muslim populations, to anyone perceived as Arab around the world.
Isn't that an awkward moment, though, right, where folks are grieving and feel fear, you know, whoever generated the fear or why it's there, you know, it's there. And our thoughts are with Palestinians.
Totally.
This is not acceptable by many people, right? Like taking that moment to push back against narratives or to question any of the official statements that come around tragedies like that is kind of like a no-go zone for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'm sure in the Jewish community, but as non-Jews too, it's kind of like, can we even speak on this right now? Is that a selfish thing to do, to worry about how this will impact the movement? And it feels really awkward. It feels callous at sometimes, but it feels very similar to October 7th, mm-hmm. to be honest, in how the media is responding and how it kind of felt, how we can talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that for most of us, you know, white Jews, I'm sort of speaking for the three of us, like, we know that our lives are held as more precious and more sacred, the same as white Christians in Western societies. And we know that when shootings occur of either of those populations, we talk endlessly about the specifics of, you know, why it happened, what we're going to do to crack down on it, and that not all life is afforded the same kind of, you know, we like to say, like, if every life is precious, then every life is precious. But we know that that's actually not the way that our governments treat human life, especially for white Jews in this moment. I think it is really sad. And I think, to your point, on the left, it's really important that we establish an ability to say that doesn't make this killing right, nor does it make the motives in line with our political fight, i.e. my political fight is for the freedom of Palestinians and the safety of everyone that wants to live on the lands that they should live on, indigenous peoples everywhere. That doesn't mean that I'm aligned with the killer of Bondi Beach. It means that I can recognize that that will be weaponized to do further harm in the movements that I support, which means that I need to develop that analysis of, I can recognize that those people should not, the people, sorry, who were killed, should not have been killed simply for being Jewish. And I can see the way in which their deaths will be used to do further harm in the movements that I'm already showing up for as a Jewish person. And it is really sad, because I think a lot of us as Jews don't even really know how to take a moment to say, it's actually kind of scary. It is actually kind of concerning that, you know, I could go to a synagogue and face increased rates of anti-Semitism or violence because Israel has been on a genocidal campaign, not just for the last 2.5 years, but for decades upon decades. And the global impunity that they receive to do that killing means that I am less safe as a Jewish person.
Absolutely. One of the largest contributors to anti-Semitism right now is Zionism and the actions of the State of Israel and the justifications that they use, the imagery that they use. And since we're going to take the time and reflect on these lives more than others, right, even we're doing it now, perhaps, wondering why it happened, what it all means, what's missing from the narrative? If media are going to latch on to this and spend time on it, how can they be doing it better?
Where to begin? I think, you know, I go to perhaps more, much more skeptical places when events like these happen. I am deeply concerned by the machinery that is in place that gets activated the moment these events happen. And I'm deeply skeptical of the Israeli state and what they're capable of doing. So I think what's missing is a lot of examination of the infrastructure that exists to proliferate what happens right after these incidents take place. And there's a lot of, and what's also missing is a lot of investigation into how such incidents happen to begin with. You know, we talk about October 7th and this feeling similar. And I think a perfect example is something like the Hannibal Directive, which, you know, if you think about the beginnings of October 7th, that, you know, the infrastructure, the media ecosystem laid the foundation the moral foundation for everything that happened next. And what we didn't hear about, and still have not had anywhere close to a reckoning about in Western media, though it has been widely reported in Israeli media, is something like the Hannibal Directive and what Israel's contribution was to that day and how deep that contribution ran. We have no idea. But what we do know for sure from the Israeli defense minister at the time, who's since spoken publicly about giving the Hannibal Directive orders, is that the Israeli war machine actually targeted Israeli citizens that day. And if that was known on day one, then perhaps we would have a very different reality than what's transpired over the past couple of years. And so I think part of this is all of us needing to not be, it's not accidental that we're not talking about this, right? We've been made to fear this conversation because of the accusations of anti-Semitism. And I think, you know, that word has now been so drained of its meaning by Zionists that I think it's incumbent upon all of us to take a much, much harder look at how all these, you know, what is actually happening. Because what I can tell you for sure is things are not as they seem on the surface.
We tend to see a real generalization. It's just a blanket hate, right? That's it. It's just this kind of blind hatred coming from...
That's the story we're pitched immediately.
Terrorists, right? And then that is then personified by the entire Arab population.
That's right.
The Islamophobia that builds up around these incidents is incredible in the worst way.
Yeah.
It green lights it, and it's scary. We did want to challenge this head on. I do see you folks doing that, but it comes with such incredible blowback, doesn't it? Especially in moments of tragedy, right? Which is why that machinery that you mentioned is activated in those moments, right? It's incredible. I feel like a conspiracy theorist. I felt very validated when you used the word machinery, because it was like cut and paste.
Yes.
They all had the same statements. I mean, the mayor of Toronto and
global. Worldwide.
Global, on all levels. They were all saying the same thing like that.
Yeah.
We've all tried to get messages out there before, right? We've got all kinds of tools at our disposal. Okay, we're all going to talk about Bill C-9 on Tuesday, this day. Nothing ever looks like that, right? This huge bombardment, and most of it against globalized the Intifada. They really grabbed onto this phrase.
Correct.
Particularly in Australia, like they've already worked that into legislation they passed within 2 weeks, which has got to be really quickly for our democracies. Does anyone want to theorize on why this phrase now, like we saw From the River to the Sea, that had kind of like, we could probably map this. Or do you have one of these maps at home where they've gone after certain phrases and maybe like just couldn't, it was like fetch, they couldn't make it happen, right? But now globalized the Intifada is being criminalized globally.
Yeah, it's the word.
Was that a concerted effort? And like, let's talk about that. Like, how folks use that moment of tragedy to really pitch this one line, right? Like, and it's going to have ramifications.
Yeah, and I think we need to start with just asking the basic question, how is it that that entire mechanism united around that phrase within hours after this tragedy? And we are now seeing, you know, a few weeks out, we're now seeing exactly what that plan is meant to be, right? We're seeing it in Toronto. We're seeing it being talked about in the papers right now. It is literally, and we have to not be scared to ask that question for fear of being labeled a conspiracy theorist or for fear of being labeled anti-Semitic, because it's, you need to ask, like, how is it possible that we've all circled around this so fast, and why this phrase this time? right? Why not something else? But I'm sure Molly and Louise might have different opinions.
Well, I was going to say that I think it's, I have a point that Gore and I sort of differ on, but I think it's important for the left to be able to debate this actually really carefully and thoroughly, which is that it's important when we have a conversation about these mechanisms and the sort of what feels like a concerted effort to criminalize something like globalize the intifada, to be really clear that on the left, there can be a likeness to a far right view that it's like the Jewish global conspiracy through Israel, like the tail that wags the dog, so to speak. Like, how does this outpost of a state, this tiny little state, have so much control over the US? And just to be really clear, that dog only exists by having places like Israel do mass weapon purchasing, you know, checking for oil in territory that is not theirs, you know, a white outpost to fight the like global war on terror. These are not accidents, and they're part of global Christian hegemonic control over many conflicts. And in fact, they look almost identical to what you might see in Venezuela, what we saw in Iraq, what we've seen in other countries where an imperial power chooses someone else to be in power over an indigenous population to have control over usually oil resources. And it's very important that the left be able to say that instead of, oh my gosh, this Israeli state manages to hold so much power, and that uniqueness is because of their Jewishness, because that is a global conspiracy theory that comes from the deepest roots of anti-Semitism from 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And it's not helpful because it actually just, like, if the political spectrum was a circle, it just moves from one end of the political spectrum and meets the far right crazy peoples on the other side, where they say, yeah, you're right, those Jews do really have a lot of power and they really do get to dictate the conversation. But like Gore said, we have to say very clearly, the dictation of this conversation comes from a global effort to silence the Palestinian right to that land. And that is part of Western Christian hegemonic interests of maintaining power over, in this case, I believe, resources. We could all debate that. That could be a whole other podcast. But it's important to say that so that then we can say, you cannot criminalize a term, globalize the intifada, because that is a people's call to take their land, the indigenous peoples of that land, and to have it and to survive and to thrive. And any use of saying, well, it's anti-Semitic to say otherwise, is absurd. And it's imperative that the left is able to parse apart those things and say, no, it's not. It is anti-Semitic to believe that Jews own that dialogue and that media narrative. But it is not anti-Semitic to say that we must challenge that and we must be in the streets fighting it. And, you know, we need to show up for our Palestinian comrades in Toronto and our Arab and Muslim comrades in Toronto who will be criminalized by this process.
I love this. Molly's so good at like explaining it all in such beautiful, beautiful terms. And I and 100% agree with everything she said. And I think part of what I personally try to do is, without getting into the far right conspiracy theorist world, is to also just help validate for people what it is they're, like, on a very basic level, on a very surfacey level, what it is they're actually witnessing. Because part of all of this is we're constantly being gaslit, right? We're constantly trying, we're being told that what we're seeing with our own eyes is not actually true. And so I'm much more like on the, you know, Molly's like in the academic plane, and I'm much more on the street, just being like, no, this is actually what you're seeing is right. it's a beautiful combination.
It is. Brings such balance. I think the point Molly made too is important and made more obvious when we start to look at the criminalization and the tools the powerful start to generate for themselves using this narrative. It clearly benefits the powerful, right? All powerful. Capital and imperialism. And gives them the tool to criminalize all dissenters, right? So I think, like, when people start to look at the ramifications of the narratives that they're using, their motivations start to unravel because, you know, they're saying they're doing it to protect this community and that community, and they're not. They're doing it all to protect their own power. Yeah. Because that is ebbing away, right? The mask has fallen. People are rising up. There is a global intifada. there's not a call for one. There is a call for one, but it is already happening. Molly says you can't criminalize it. I wanted to correct you. They are, right? Like, we're going to push back against it, but just, I'm going to spit a few figures out before, and then I'm going to Louise, right? We're going to talk about Canada. I won't steal any of your thunder there, but you know, in the UK, we're already seeing, and we've talked about this a little bit on the show, like hundreds, we're in the thousands now. It's like this year, so 2025, we're not even done yet, 1,630 arrests linked to Palestinian Action, which is like a 660% increase on terror charges. These are terror charges that carry like minimum 7 years, max 14. That's about 30 people a day being arrested in the United Kingdom for simply saying they support Palestine Action, right? Not for committing acts of what you would consider acts of terrorism, like kind of textbook, even though there isn't one that we would all agree on, but that's another topic altogether. But, you know, like literally sitting there, you know, Greta Thunberg is one of the examples that you can most recently see, cross-legged, holding a cardboard sign. I oppose genocide. I support Palestinian Action. And that could get you 7 years in prison. Two arrests since Bondi in the UK have been directly linked to chanting "Globalize the Intifada." So even though that wasn't part of the legislation, that no court has kind of ruled on that, it has already been worked up into the patterns that are happening there. And I mentioned this briefly, Australia did in fact pass legislation. They will include in hate speech, "Globalize the Intifada." And Gur, you hinted towards to Toronto. I mentioned Chow there, but Pasternak, our favorite counselor to hate right now, is suggesting, you know, even the Palestinian flag itself is a form of harassment and should be, the use of it should be curbed. So
it's so obscene, like the obscenity and the entitlement to be so obscene about other people's reality is, there are no words, literally no words for that. I'm always like, I'm sure we all are. We're all always just like with our chins on the floor for what people like Pasternak are capable of doing and asking for on a daily basis. It's obscene.
Yeah, they're looking to the UK and being like, yes, more please, over here, right? They would fill the jails. We don't even have capacity for that. I mean, they'll create capacity, but it's like they think these are just, we think that they're just throwaway comments, right? Oh, that counselor's going off again. They're laying the groundwork for actual legislation. Right, Louise?
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like so many of these threads and things that both Molly and Gore are talking about have been so obvious in following the debates that have been happening around Bill C-9. And it feels like people's racism is fully on display. Like no one is pretending, they're not trying to mask it anymore. It's very upfront and center in the conversations that have been happening about the legislation. And it's been interesting to see as it evolves and the infighting between the political parties about which rights are going to be taken away and for which people. It's been really revealing. And I don't know if I should first do kind of an overview of what's actually in the legislation. Is it now a helpful time?
Let's do that, but please make sure you put a pin. I want to hear your reflections on that infighting and how that looks for Canadian politics.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's been really interesting to see how animated the conversations are and sort of the posturing between the parties on this. So I'll say that the Bill C-9, the Combating Hate Act, was introduced by the Liberals, and as part of a campaign commitment that they had made to introduce this legislation. So I can just speak to some of the key changes that the legislation introduces, and then we can kind of like unpack them a little bit. So one of the upfront elements that they have is right now the Attorney General has to consent before hate charges can be laid. They're looking at removing that requirement. They've created a hate symbol offense that says that it is a crime to promote hatred against an identifiable group if you are displaying certain symbols. And the symbols that some of them are explicitly named. So there are some Nazi symbols that were explicitly named in the legislation. Then they also say symbols that are associated with entities listed on Canada's terrorist list. And then the craziest part of it is that there is a third category, which is symbols that closely resemble symbols of one of those terrorist entities. If it is seen to be close enough to one of those, then that can also be an offense. And we'll come back to why that one is particularly terrifying.
Alarm bells are already going off in the audience's mind. Yeah.
Right? I mean, you can just see how it's going to be misused. And on that one, it feels like the centering of most of the mainstream conversations about this legislation that I've seen, at least in mainstream media, has been like a one sentence, this bill will mean that you can't bring a swastika to a synagogue, is sort of like the high level attention that it gets paid from the mainstream media, which is a real failure of our media, because obviously that is, you know, an emotional issue that most people hearing that would be like, yeah, sure, you shouldn't bring a swastika to a synagogue. But that's not actually what this legislation is about. It is lazy journalism to like just pick that one specific thing and say, see, this legislation is totally valid because of this one tiny thing, which we know is not how this is going to be used. And then the other ones that I find really terrible are an intimidation offense, which says that you can't intentionally provoke fear in people trying to access buildings that are being used for religious worship or by identifiable groups for social, cultural, or other purposes. So if people inside a building feel that you are impeding their access by making them fearful, you can be charged with up to 10 years in prison. And a related offense to that around obstruction. So if you are seen to be obstructing people entering those kinds of buildings. And the buildings that they name, it's really broad. Cultural centers, sports arenas, if they are used for an identifiable group.
Similar to the bubble laws.
Except in some ways worse, because there is no distance. There's no boundary for this law. It's basically people's feelings. So if people are feeling fearful and accuse protesters, let's say, for making them feel fearful, then the police can charge people. If people are in a crowd and they see somebody holding a black flag with white Arabic writing on it, they can say that it resembles an ISIS flag. It could say peace on earth, but if it resembles an ISIS flag, they can be charged under this legislation. And we know who gets targeted by these types of laws, and we can see it directly in the debate, that this is largely about Palestine solidarity. And one of the ways we can see that unfolding, I'll mention two other private members' bills that have been introduced that have got thrown into this discourse around the Combating Hate Act. And that is that the Conservatives introduced a private members' bill that would criminalize, their language is promoting any terrorist activity, any terrorist group, or any activity of a terrorist group. And what we know from the way they've talked about this is when they see Palestine Solidarity activists in the street, doesn't matter what people are calling for or where they're protesting, you know, if they're like on Parliament Hill, if they're outside an MP's office, it doesn't matter where the protest is happening. The claim will be that they are Hamas supporters, that they are promoting terrorism. And now they're trying to to make that the next link to that, which is to say that if you are in the street supporting Palestine, you are supporting Hamas, therefore you are supporting a terrorist group, and you can be charged under this proposed private members bill.
Well, they've been making those claims, right, for longer than 2 years now, right? Hamas feels no ways about using that language to describe all protesters, right? Hamas supporters. And like we've been saying for so long, like this language fucking matters. And now we're seeing like this next step, Louise, right? Where it's codified criminalization, not just a smear, right? Not just, oh, I'll make it harder for you to get a job. I'll make you look bad. I'll discredit your story and your point of view by using this language. This is, I will take away your freedom and put you in prison for 10 years.
Yeah, 100%. And there's so much more I want to build on that. But first, just to say that there is a third bill that also gets in the mix here. And that is that the Bloc Québécois, they are secularist. So they are on an ongoing campaign to remove any religious related protections in general. And so they have an ongoing mission to try to remove an exemption that's in the criminal code right now, which is that you can't be convicted of promoting hateful or anti-Semitic speech if it is expressed as a good faith opinion based on belief in a religious text. So that exists right now, that exemption, and the Bloc is trying to get it removed. And because of the political disagreements on whose rights we want to take away first and how, the Conservatives refuse to support the Liberal Bill C-9.
Of course.
So the Liberals and the Bloc came together, and the Liberals agreed to support this the removal of the religious exemption so that the Bloc would support C-9. So, yes, but the Conservatives lost their minds about this because obviously they wanted to be the ones to be both continuing to defend Israel, to continuing to use their racist campaign against Muslims. But they lost the ability to have that, you know, to be able to hold the Liberals, right? Because the Bloc agreed to support the legislation. And then by introducing the religious exemption removal, suddenly the Conservatives had to protect the interests of all of the Christian organizations that want to protect their ability
to be anti-Semitic.
To be anti-Semitic. And anti-Muslim, anti-LGBTQ, like all of these things that right now is protected by these, you know, protections that are given to religious speech. So in the committee hearing around Bill C-9, suddenly there was all this vested interest in protecting Christian rights. So the whole conversation has sort of devolved into everybody trying to defend the people that they think are deserving of the ability to have speech that is not criminalized and whose speech is justified to be criminalized. So it was just such a microcosm.
You really can't make this stuff up. Yeah.
Full of hypocrisies, right? Like just saturated.
Full of hypocrisy. Yeah.
And Jessa, I'm so sorry because there's so much in what Louise said that I think is important in terms of like the politics, but I just want to pick up on something to make sure that listeners heard this. When you have feelings being used as like codified into law around hate speech, everyone should be up in arms because we already have laws to protect people from hate speech. But the allowance and the sort of flourishing, and as you said, this began after October 7th. I mean, it actually began before, but in a bigger way, it sort of came to be after October 7th, where a Jewish person could say, I feel uncomfortable. I feel that you are being anti-Semitic because you support Palestine. And now what Louise is saying is that idea that a feeling is enough to then criminalize someone is absolutely crazy. And we have it, it's not just like, this isn't like a hypothetical. They're actually using this for discussions about charter rights and freedoms, I almost said feelings, which has allowed conversations about a traumatized population, which is basically a post-Holocaust population of people who are deeply traumatized, Jewish people in Canada is who I'm referring to, who the vast majority of identify overly strongly with Zionism and the State of Israel are saying any criticism of that is anti-Semitism because I feel that it is, even though that's an absurd idea. So just to make sure that people caught that, that the feeling then becomes the law, which is just like, no one ever wants that for any group of people.
Yeah. And just to build on like the real world implications of that. So we've seen so much, obviously, within Palestine Solidarity about how that happens. And in us writing to federal members to say, like, you have to understand how this translates into real world things. And so one of the things that we've quoted in what we shared with them was that last year at a meeting in Ottawa, the Ottawa Carleton District School Board meeting, one of the trustees, Neely Kaplan-Mertz, stated that the sight of a keffiyeh, Palestinian scarf, worn by a presenter was an act of aggression. And she wanted an apology. She wanted it stopped. She, like, somebody's article of clothing. And it's bigger than the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And there's also, we also looked at research around how Black men are perceived. Mm-hmm. And what it means when you allow people for their fears to justify their behaviors and their actions.
We're talking about cops.
And there's a study by the University of Toronto that showed that Black men are perceived to be larger and more threatening than similarly sized white men. And there's research to show that unarmed Black men are more likely to be shot and killed by police. And that often when police talk about it, they reference the physical size of the person as part of how they were assessing the situation. So it's already these things translate into justification for bad behavior that can put people's lives at risk by elevating how important somebody's feelings are instead of unpacking why are they afraid? Is that fear justifiable? Is there an actual risk to them? But those conversations aren't happening.
In court cases, they're almost unable to happen, right? Because fear is a personal, it's a perception. There's no way to go in and verify if that person is actually fearful or not. And that's what happens in a lot of police defense cases, right? Where the court is left going, well, if he said he was fearful, that's all that we needed to acquit, right? And I can't challenge that because that is an internal manifestation that is unique to everybody. It has me looking at my magnet there that says your feelings are valid. It's right there. And I'm going, they're valid, right? That fear can be valid, but there's a but, right? But it cannot lead to the infringement of the charter rights and freedoms and stuff like that Louise was talking about.
Exactly. And when the Christian right then aligns with that kind of movement, the group that always will remain in power, you touched on this before, Jessa, the group that always remains in power and that is actually able to change all these policies is the Christian dominant political parties and institutions. And what they will ensure is that allowing a dialogue in which Jewish feelings matter more than other people's feelings contribute to anti-Semitism. And who does that benefit the most? It benefits the Christian right, because now we have the classic perfect scapegoat of every time period ever, the Jew. Which is to say that this whole thing, C9, can be blamed very easily, and you wouldn't be wrong to look as an average Canadian to look and say, God, Jews get really special treatment in this country because their feelings are privileged over every other group of people. And you're not wrong to have that feeling. It's that it's actually being propped up by Christian dominant powers that be that say, let's make sure we treat these people with the absolute kid gloves so that we can then have a scapegoat when things go awry for us, which is when the economy is bad, when we know that there is anti-immigrant sentiment on the rise, which are all things that are happening in Canada right now.
Let's go back to Bill C-9. The increase in maximum sentencing, is that the 10 years that you were talking about?
Yeah, it's really terrifying. The potential prison terms for some of these offenses. And again, disproportionate to what the actual charge is, right? The charge of making somebody afraid to enter a building that can land you in for 10 years in prison. And when we see the vitriol, right, and the way that people really draw out like what is being said and reinterpreted, right? When people claim that saying from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free actually means exterminate the Jews. Like, it is outsiders who are claiming that that's what that phrase means. And to make that be the way that the police are allowed to interpret things, we don't do that for other things, right? Like, people keep trying to say, like, what they are calling for is freedom from an oppressive regime that has been in place for decades, that is well documented to be an apartheid state, to be an occupying force, to be committing war crimes and genocide. Like, there have been so much documentation of all of these things. And when people are saying that right now what exists within Israel and Palestine are anti-democratic and not the way anybody should be forced to live, and that calling for that freedom is actually about violence, is such an inversion of what's happening, right? Like, people are saying we are subjected to apartheid laws, we do not have freedom on our own land, there is no equality, and that is being twisted into something that is actually about Jewish suffering. And then to say, we're going to grant the police the ability to decide whether or not that means somebody should be in prison for 10 years. It's so disproportionate. And the courts, there have been rulings by courts in Canada that have looked at the use of that phrase and have said, actually, it's not anti-Semitic. For the University of Toronto encampment, there was a case brought against people who were occupying U of T. And one of the claims that was made was that the basis of that movement was anti-Semitism, which again is like absolutely centering the wrong people, right? This isn't about Jews. This is about the Israeli state. In that court proceeding, the judge found that the slogan was not anti-Semitic and said himself that while these expressions may be perceived as hurtful and threatening to Jews, he did not see evidence that they were being used with intention of violence, anti-Semitism, or hatred. And yet our politicians insist on claiming that that is the motivation, as if they have some kind of special knowledge about what people are intending, other than what they are actually telling them that they're intending. So it's consolidating power in the hands of the people who already have that power. And when we talk about people like Councillor Pasternak, who has been on this mission for 20 years, trying to say that there should never be protesters in the street with Palestinian flags. And it's also Olivia Chow calling all of these, rallies hateful, which then feeds into this narrative of, well, we criminalize hateful things, even though actually we don't, but more and more we are trying to. And then she's also, on a podcast recently talking about how the problem is that the police charges aren't sticking and that the police and the courts should be working harder to make the charges stick instead of looking at why they're not sticking. And they're not sticking because people are being charged for things that are trumped up and that don't actually meet the thresholds. And so people are being charged and their lives are being ruined and they're losing their jobs. And the mayor of our city thinks that the problem is not that they were charged to begin with, but that they haven't found a way to make the charges stick. And then we see all these new pieces of legislation that are being introduced to try to tighten that rope, right? And say, like, okay, well, it hasn't been working so far, so we're just going to increasingly criminalize things. And eventually some of these charges will stick, which is very concerning and anti-democratic.
It is. And it drives me crazy when folks don't make that connection. Like, they think it's just, isn't that weird how Olivia Chow's calling for something and Mark Carney has it written up and ready to go? Like, the same thing happened in the UK, right? So the genocide accelerated, people started accelerating their actions, and cops started arresting Palestinian action for destroying Elbit systems, weapons, yay, shout out to them. But juries were letting them off. They weren't getting the convictions they needed there at all. They were actually legally able to use the protection of Palestinians as a defense, and it outweighed the harms which the judge thought or the jury believed that they were committing, right? It was a defense that was allowed. And so what did they do? They changed the law. A judge may rule that the globalized Intifada is was not criminal, but not if you change the criminal code to say it is. So, like, every time these bills come out in my notes is like, why? Everyone always like, why would they do something like that that seems so dangerous and so bad? And it's like, well, yeah, their motivations were they're getting their ass handed to them in the courtroom, right? So their goal of actually criminalizing is more in the abstract, right? It's in the punishment of process, and we've talked about that. It's not like those people don't go through hell and back being charged, but they aren't getting convictions. And that's embarrassing, it's wasting resources, and it's not helping to reaffirm their narrative. What do you mean they're not criminals? I told you they were all criminals. I need to prove to you they are criminals. That means locking them up. I'd like to spend a little bit of time drawing that connection we talked about at the beginning. Molly hinted at it, where, you know, we do focus on the weaponization of anti-Semitism, but for an imperialist good, right? Good in scare quotes there. Can we talk about what you folks think the motivations might be behind this outside of Palestine? Because Kearney is not fully, wholly invested in Palestine as a single issue, right? He has other plans that he will need to suppress other people. And not that we want to appeal to the right, but that includes you folks. If you're listening, they're not. There's no way they've made it this far. But they do need to realize that these laws will be used to curtail any dissent that they might have or any challenge they might pose to power. Indigenous land defenders, right? So just maybe talk about, any one of you can pick this up, you know, the motivations behind legislation like this, beyond the movement.
I had a big one when Louise was talking, and just the connection you just made, I think is so smart about, like, what are the government's actual broader schemes. And it is a nice, in one way, it's a nice thing, which is the movements are actually working. These movements have shut down commerce in such a way, have costed people so much money. The Palestinian freedom and justice movements that have taken storm across Canada and the United States after October 7th, of course, decades before, have actually forced, like, I believe that governments are saying, their investment in the money making of selling weapons, they are mad that they can't do that unabated. And so they are like, we will stop this through criminalizing dissent. And actually, this is super helpful because it also criminalizes dissent, like you said, that costs us lots of money when Indigenous land defenders, you know, take up their actual charter rights to say, no, you can't build this pipeline across my lands. So I think it's like a twofold that, like, the support of this particular genocide and any genocide for that matter, where, you know, we get to sell weapons. For example, we just shipped two armored vehicles produced by Rochelle, which is this like Israeli company in Brampton that had been named in one of the biggest PYM reports of shipping weapons to Israel. We sent those armored vehicles into cities in the United States, which people should be enraged by. Canadian taxpayers should be paying attention, for ICE to use on citizens of the United States. So when we as movements disrupt money, I think that governments are very clear that that needs to be shut down. And so I think that there is a big motivation here to ensure that capital continues to flow and deadly capital is not interrupted at all. And I think that that aligns perfectly with, like you said, anti-Indigenous legislation, but also anti-immigrant. We know that we are gearing up for our own version of, you know, raids on people who don't have their full citizenship, you know, so there's so many more pieces that will come. But I think it's really important to talk about the capital interests here, because our governments make money off of these wars, and they want to continue that unabated. And they want to make sure that our charter backs them up in that, which is just completely bananas.
One of the things that it's a couple months ago already, after Donald Trump had declared Antifa a terrorist organization in the States, we saw Pierre Poilievre suggesting that this was something that he would want to do here. And so immediately with this legislation, what comes to mind for me is, like, let's imagine a scenario where that happens, right? Let's imagine a scenario where Antifa is designated a terrorist organization. Anybody with a brain knows, you know, it's that's not a single thing. There's not like a consolidated Antifa organization that is centrally coordinated, you know.
But there are symbols.
there are symbols, and there are, you know, it's broadly captures a lot of different kinds of things, right? It's like opposing fascism, white supremacy, other forms of oppression. If you decide that it is a terrorist entity, and then you have legislation that says any symbols connected to that terrorist entity, then that means that there's a future where this kind of legislation can be used to criminalize any kind of protest. That's indigenous land rights, immigrant justice, workers' rights, climate change, anything can be seen as under the umbrella of Antifa. And it's left up to the government and the police to decide what that is. And we know that politicians tell us endlessly that they don't control the police. And yet then they are writing things and going on TV shows and going on podcasts and making it very clear to the police what their expectations are for them to be doing to justify their budget increases and inviting them to their galas, like all of these, you know, Zionist Jewish organizations who have the police come to their events and then turn around and say, we don't influence the police. Like, of course you do. You take them on trips to Israel. Like, you're not doing those things, you know, just to be neighborly. Like, you're doing those things because there's something you're going to get out of it, you know, and what you're going to get out of it is that you have convinced them that Arabs and Palestinians and Muslims are terrifying, and therefore their existence has to be criminalized. And it's the police that are given the power to enforce it. Just to say also that it feels like there has not been a lot of reaction from organized labor about this legislation. And that also seems like concerning that if we put this back in the hands of the people who are being protested against and them deciding that they are being made to feel fearful about accessing a building, like, that is innately what picketing is doing, right? It's trying to dissuade people from accessing a space, which is a charter protected right and is so fundamental to like social change. And now this legislation is saying, no, if you are invoking fear to impede access to a building, you can be in prison for 10 years. And
that's the intimidation offense that you're talking about, right?
Yeah. And I don't know where labor is on this. I feel like we haven't seen a lot of pushback.
I feel like they think that they're going to be constitutionally protected to do their traditional pickets. That remains to be seen. But I know non-unionized workers who form picket lines and do try to intimidate bosses into paying back stolen wages will be cleared, if not arrested. So that is a good question. I mean, that question comes around on a lot of issues. Migrant rights, you know, there's a few players out there. But in general, I don't think I've seen a big enough push from the entire political left on this, and partly because it gets wrapped up in things like Bondi Beach, right? Where it's, is it worth wading into this discussion? It's a little uncomfortable. I don't understand it. It won't affect me right now. And it absolutely will, though, right? It absolutely will. Louise, you mentioned Antifa, and I had a chuckle. I shouldn't have laughed, because it's kind of like laughing off those silly statements isn't all that helpful either. Like, we try not to let it bother us. But pushing back against it's important because it leads to all the things that we've just talked about. And in Australia, they're not waiting for, you know, Antifa to be declared or the language to be very specific on who is allowed. Part of the change that they made in a state within Australia was like, no, they could ban all public protests for 3 months following a declaration of terrorism. And that is not defined, right? On what that declaration is or looks like or what terrorism is. And that's so broad. So, and they can just blanketly ban for up to 3 months. So we can already see the tools are there for the powerful to suppress us. They've just used this kind of, the timing is just awful. You know, that mechanism that you talked about, and then the fact that Bill C-9, where is it now? It's in committee. Is that right?
Yeah. So the committee has totally devolved because
I bet
the conservatives were so mad that they started filibustering the committee. And then they introduced a motion right after the Bloc and the Liberals passed the religious exemption removal. The conservatives came forward with a motion to say that whatever is done should not interfere with people's right to religious expression. So they tried to put a like an external, like an asterisk, and be like, yeah, you can do all of these things, but only until the point where it interferes with somebody's religious expression, which of course, if you're doing that, you're like undermining the whole thing, right? So then they entered into all this debate around all this, and the conservatives brought in all these MPs who were not typically members of the committee, but they sort of brought them in, I'm assuming because it was suddenly very important for them to represent their constituencies, to say that like, this is anti-Christian now. So they started talking about all the ways this is anti-Christian.
They're debating all the wrong things, right? Is that...
they are absolutely debating all the wrong things. But the committee meetings were like the last one that I watched, it ended at 11:30 p.m. And then eventually the committee chair was just like, okay, we're done. One of the interesting things to watch has been that the conservatives, because they seem so insistent that they are not going to support a liberal bill, that they've been taking this stand on it, that it will, you know, it will silence dissent. It will, they were like, even some of the conservative members were quoting Canadian civil liberties, BC civil liberties, talking about how this is taking away people's rights and therefore they can't support it.
Oh.
And then in the next breath, they're talking about how the Jewish community is being targeted by slogans and how definitely we shouldn't allow people to do that. So it's like they're trying to have it both ways. They don't want to support the liberal bill, but they're also saying that people's speech should be silenced, but just in this one very specific way.
I've seen some of them arguing that they're upset the hammer and sickle wasn't included.
Yes. Yes. Someone introduced a motion.
I would have a problem in my house.
Yeah. It's also like Melissa Lantzman,
you know. We're name dropping all the worst people.
I know, right? And she went on a thing in the committee about how she's been hearing from rabbis. She said something like, you know, like, I've talked to 50 rabbis today who are concerned about when they go up to preach from the pulpit, that they now have to worry about what they might say. And I'm thinking, like, if there are that many rabbis who are concerned about what they're saying in a synagogue setting, like, that is actually a concern. Like, that is problematic. If they don't think they can make a sermon without potentially being charged with a hate crime, like that's a concern, right? And when we think about like, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu and how he used language from scripture to justify murdering every Palestinian, like this thing where he called them Amalek, and like, I went to Hebrew school growing up and I was like, yeah, whatever, like Amalek, like who takes that seriously anymore? And then I actually read the quote, and the full quote is, it's basically justifying that anybody who is from that heritage is somebody who you are entitled to murder because you don't want to like further that identity, which is so deeply, deeply messed up.
And genocidal.
Genocidal. And the guy who actually is running a country, like it's not the same as somebody standing on a street corner and just like saying shit, right? This is a guy who actually has the authority and has been proving to the world that he is comfortable murdering children and babies and men, and like, and none of those people deserve it. And, you know, he has all of these things available to him, and then he invokes scripture as a way to justify it. And here we are sitting and debating about like which words we should be allowed to say in Canada. It's so deeply disturbing. And every political party, what we're seeing is every political party is taking a piece of this, right? Like none of them are saying we should defend people's free expression. They're all just trying to find different variations on what should be protected and what should be criminalized. And we should all be concerned because we can see very clearly in the States, like we have such a window into how fascism picks up speed and is able to do increasingly terrible things if people don't stand up and stop it. Like we can see it unfolding in real time, and there's not enough focus on it happening here. Like I feel like right. There just has not been enough discussion about this legislation in, you know, general mainstream kind of conversations and media. And it's really like, this is the beginning of something really, well, it's not, it's a continuation of something really scary, but it's taking it to much more severe places.
We're far more slick, right? Like Trump does it with executive orders and blanket statements and like illegal moves. But the Canadian government is just lining up the very same legislation for migrant removals and denying Indigenous sovereignty and, you know, muscling through projects and all of these things, but through respectable forms of legislation with debates and committees. And so it feels a lot more wholesome than an angry man standing up there and just declaring it so, yeah. Right? But the end result will be the same. Canadians do that a lot, right? To deflect from our own awfulness. We just find someone more awful or with poorer PR, Edgar, right? Like the United States gets a bad rap, but because we're just as bad sometimes in our imperialist adventures. We've had a few episodes like that. Anybody want to have any last words before we sign off? Maybe even Gur, if you could give us an idea of how we could best talk about this, you know, without being dismissive of that fear, but also not feeding into the narratives that are being weaponized against us.
I wish I had the answer. I'm not.
No, you can't shake your head.
I'm not the right person for that question. I think Molly is probably much better suited for that question because I am so angry. I mean, I'm so angry, yeah, right? I'm just so angry about what's been done with those terms and how that's been flung in people's faces, how it's truly been weaponized every which possible way without the slightest bit of care for people's lives and livelihoods. I've given up on that term basically. But Molly, please.
There's only one answer, and it's always the same, which is safety through solidarity. So if the left genuinely cares about anti-Semitism, then it works, because then you can fight the way it is weaponized. And so that means having a very sharp analysis about what anti-Semitism is, just the same way that you should have one. We should all have one about what anti-Black racism looks like, what anti-Indigenous specific racism looks like, the way that the right tries to pit every oppressed group against each other in order to have us fight each other. And for us, we have to say, no, we will fight all of these isms together. And that if we can do that, then when it is weaponized, we are more able to say, as a non-Jewish left, actually, you can't weaponize that in order to silence protest for Palestine, and that we all will develop sharper analyses of all the ways that these oppressions are linked, and that really the people who benefit are always the same people, the Christians, the Christian hegemonic power structures. You know, it's so funny that Louisa's C9 example says that they're like, actually, we need to maintain our ability to be discriminatory. The Christians are like outraged. But that's a really obvious answer. It points to the ultimate power holders, especially in Canada, who are often the same ones that they always have been.
They always seem to benefit from genocide.
Yeah, exactly. Weird. That's how we all got to this country. So, yeah.
You know, you folks not only helped unpack this weaponization that we're talking about, but helped to understand why the Canadian state acts the way that it does. Because that does perplex some people who have this image that Canadians are good, our government in the most part acts in our best interest. You know, those people still exist en masse. They might not be listening to this show, though. But, you know, it is often, why do they act this way? Why would they bother, even if it's just hot potato, right? Why would you sit on such a hot topic right now and support a genocide? But it all starts to make sense, right? When you look at the big picture and have articulate people to help explain it. So I do appreciate your time here in the studio and doing the slog out there. I know it's hard work, and I hope you're taking care of one another.
Thanks, Jessa. Yeah, thanks for having us.
Awesome. Thanks, Jessa.
Thank you so much, Jessa.
That is a wrap on another episode of Blueprints of Disruption. Thank you for joining us. You can follow us on Twitter at BP of Disruption. If you'd like to help us continue disrupting the status quo, please share our content. And if you have the means, consider becoming a patron. Not only does our support come from the progressive community, so does our content.
So reach out to us and let us know what or who we should be amplifying. So until next time, keep disrupting.